I'm gonna go back. I'm gonna take us back in time though to start off to get us in the groove. I want to ask about how y'all met initially, how your creative partnership began. Because I watched some of your early shorts a few days ago. I watched Life of an Artiste and Couch of Culpability, and then I watched Adventures in Caribbean Country, and I wasn't amazed because I'd seen the Paperboy before, but like your comedic voices are already like. At least you can see a lot of what he would develop into in that early work. And it's, that early work is already really funny. Although Caribbean Country is more dramatic than I was expecting to be. can you all just talk about your early days?
Go for it, Farley. You want
to? Yeah. Charlie was a sophomore at Providence College. I was a freshman, and we lived on the same floor, McDermott Hall. And a mutual friend introduced us and said, "You guys both like to make movies," and that was about all we needed. That month, we were already making our first short movie, and basically, for the next 3 years, kept making movies, leading up to a feature length called The Paperboy, in which I play a guy who I'm like a superhero who can write papers for college students really quick. It's my little money making scheme. And then after college, when most people say, well, we can't just keep on making these weird movies that no one wants to watch. That's what most people say, but we were like, let's keep making these weird movies that nobody wants to watch. And basically that's what leads us up to this very day.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, right when I met Farley, that first day, I said, well, maybe one day we'll play at the Buff Film Festival. And I can't believe it, you know?
Those pajamas too.
Yes. So yeah, I worked at the media center at college. So, people have to wrap their head around the fact that I was editing tape to tape on the Paperboy. So it was built sequentially. So any edit that's wrong, you have to either go back in time and completely re-edit the movie from that point, or you can do an insert edit, but it has to time out exactly what you're going on top of, the footage you're inserting on top of. So and then leading up from that, after we graduated, when we made Caribbean Country, I mean, it wasn't feasible to even share video easily on the internet at that time. So it'd be like Farley would have to drive down and we would like watch in the studio the cut, or I would have to ship him a VHS because I didn't have a DVD burner even at that time. So it's unique time. And then that parlays into, I'd say, not a lot of self-distribution. So, YouTube isn't really out yet. Then even when it comes out, it's limited to 10 minutes and no one's really wanting to watch, you could do it, but you have the chunk of the movie. So we were making these movies just because we wanted to, but there was really no outlet for it. Although we did play at a couple tiny festivals, including the Yellowstone National
West
Park.
West Yellowstone.
West Yellowstone Film Festival, where we were honored with an amateur storyline award.
Yeah,
best amateur storyline.
What Charlie is pointing out and needs to be emphasized is we made five feature length films at a time when there was really no way to show them to anybody. Like. Most of the people who were in the movie didn't even want to watch it, and that didn't stop us in any way from immediately getting to work on the next movie. So it's really, we lucked out in that technology advanced to the point where getting your movie out there became easier and easier. And by then we had like a backlog of titles that we'd made. And so, yeah, thank God for technology.
And even though there wasn't a real like audience for it, since it was so fun for us to kind of like we're laughing in the woods, doing all this crazy stuff, going over to Kevin McGee's house, having him put on a druid cloak to play a druid. We're running around in downtown Manchester. All that stuff was so, wild and fun. It wasn't like you made a heavy, emotionally heavy movie and then no one watched it. It's like, well, we were swinging on ropes, we were fighting druids, we were climbing rocks, we were doing all this wild stuff and just getting more used to like the camera and editing and all that, so we had we had real projects we were finishing as opposed to just doing like tutorials online or just stuff that was never going to result in something. It's like, well, might as well just film and then end up with something.
So it's like, yeah, like Charlie said, it's all about like learning by doing, and in a way, you learn to finish a project that way too. And what I basically every movie we've ever made, it's always just get it by the end. It's like just get it done. I don't even care anymore. I forget what this movie's about. I just get it done, and that's we're at that stage in Evil Puddle, which we're making right now. Like one more day of filming, just whatever it takes, get this awful movie finished so we can do the next one that we're totally pumped about.
Yeah, you can be free from it. I understand the feeling. Thank you. That's great. And I really like what you say about like it's making it is fun in the first place, right? There's some bits in Crewman Country where you're just like hanging out in the woods, and I'm like, these woods are so beautiful. It must have been very nice to just film the woods.
Yeah, because no one's going to yell at you. You aren't bothering any family members. There really was nobody around. You're not spending, money to be there. And it's like a free set. You're not messing up your house or your apartment or anything. So it's pretty cool. I mean, when you're there, you're only limited by your imagination of what shots you want to get and what you can technically get. But I mean, Farley and I were there by ourselves, putting the camera on a tripod, run over, hit record, run. 5 minutes in the other direction and then hike toward the camera. So, I mean, there's a lot of raw footage where it's me sprinting toward the camera to save DV tape,
Yeah, we worked weird. We didn't have like 9 to 5 jobs, and so oftentimes the filming day would be like a Tuesday, from 10 a.m. till 5 p.m. And so we'd go to these state forests where there's not many people anyway, but especially at a Tuesday at 1 p.m. And so we really felt like we owned the area. And I should point out, to this day, Charlie and I have always lived at least 3 hour drives from each other. So, it's always been something we have to set up like, all right, we're gonna meet on this particular day and film all day, and then whoever drove to the other guy will have to either stay over or drive home. And in a way, that's good because it's like, all right, we're doing this. This is not like a casual thing. Someone had to get up at 5 in the morning and drive for 3 hours to make this happen. So, we're not gonna dilly-dally.
Right. Okay, so now let's jump ahead to Mansion Vegas, which is like 7 or 8 years later, right? You've been making movies on tape and DV, and now you're making two movies on film. You're making Freaky Farley and Monsters, Murder, and Marriage in Mansion Vegas. How did this happen? How did the choice to shoot on film come up?
It was really up to Charlie because I didn't know how to work a mini DV camera or a film camera, so I was at Charlie's mercy and still am.
Well, I think it was just I had done some music videos, and then Farley came and visited when I was shooting one of them, and Tom too. Our buddy Tom, who we went to college with, is a big part of all this. But when we saw that we liked how it looked, and we were watching during this, or a lot of what we were watching during a certain time was VHS horror movies, r a lot of rural regional ones if we could. So if there was a way that even though we're 20 plus years past the boom of that time where you could make one of those and sell them, we still wanted to, I think, be a part of that tradition. So it's like, well, they made this movie in Utah and someone made this movie back in the day in New Jersey or Florida. Like, what if we try to do our thing here in New England and just, step up and do it? And,
And those movies were made on 16mm or Super 16mm for the most part, right, Charlie?
So we had the, film, and we had a lens from the 70s, and we're kind of like a part of that tradition, and it's giving it a certain like timeless, and also I don't know what, it just gives you more of a narrative quality, and it's like a special kind of quality that you're getting. And we're filming in all these vintage towns, and I don't know, I think it just added like a warmness, and also it made the movies seem more real, and people had to take it a little more seriously. I mean, Farley could probably speak to this, but when the camera's rolling and film's burning through, people are, you gotta deliver.
Yeah. And just, the mini DV was nice, but it kind of looked like local TV news broadcast, whereas the film looks like a movie to, especially to us growing up on movies that were shot on film.
And I read in the Moturn on Moturn book, I think, Charlie, that you couldn't even see. You just had to use the viewfinder, right? You weren't looking at any of the footage when you were shooting. You were just faith all faith in
No.
the process.
Yeah, it costs too much to either get like obviously film dailies. We weren't going to be getting the film dailies and projecting them, but if we got the dailies transferred to like a drive or a disc or something, it was just going to be too much. So like at the end of both of those movies, we had a box, a big cardboard box that was just filled with the film cans. Put some tape on there. Put a note on inside, please develop this and transfer it, send it to the place. That was the movie. The movie was just in that box and there's no backup and we hadn't seen any of it. But that
Yeah,
was the
yeah.
only
So
way to
if
do it.
that box, yeah, if it was deliver, if it was damaged in the delivery, then just all the work we'd done for the previous 2.5 weeks of nonstop filming. Oh well, we'll never see it.
Yeah, and months of writing it and yeah,
Yeah, oh
everything.
yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Just getting stressed out thinking about that. Getting stressed out that you're waiting time. And I want to go back to the movies in specific, but you mentioned being really into a lot of these kind of 16 millimeter regional horror movies, watching at the time. Can you name any specifics that were really speaking to you? I know y'all are big fans of The Pit. Are there any other ones?
The Don Dohler movies we liked. Rana, what Rabane was doing up in Wisconsin,
A new horror
that
film
was
featured on the Bill Rabane box set as well. Great, yeah.
yeah. So we were just getting these, not even like remastered versions or special edition versions. We went into the random video store next to the grocery store and picked up like 10 rentals for $10, the original tape from 1983, and went home and watched it in marathon format, me, Farley, and Tom, and then like took notes. So we were learning about all these movies, and then we would the McCulloughs, and I also love Blood Cult a lot from Oklahoma, even though that was shot on video. But we're taking notes about the story and the comedy that we're liking, and then also just kind of seeing how they would do it. But yeah, I think those are some good examples. Also, I'm a big fan of John McBride, Woodchipper Massacre, which was made in Connecticut on video. But like you said, The Pit, that in terms of the wild anything goes comedy and being a little bit more of a real movie, that one's kind of like Mount Rushmore, like epic. Like we love we were watching that in college even before we started, making some of the features. What do you think, Farley? Did I forget any of our any really good B movie people or regional?
I mean, those are the ones more on the level that we were making than like a notch above us in terms of budgeting, Friday the 13th, the early Friday the 13th movies, and Silent Night, Deadly Night, Part Two, Slumber Party Massacre, Part Three, stuff like that, which is definitely, more advanced, but still inspirational.
Yeah. And then when we were watching all those, we got into the TV movies too. Because occasionally we would happen upon one that I haven't really heard of this, has a good title, maybe had a good VHS box, and we put it in and be like, oh, then you see the commercial breaks. And you could
Yeah.
kind of tell it's a TV movie, but we really hit some gems there, like Deathstalk,
Ants. Is
Ants,
it Ants made for
yeah.
TV?
Ants, yes.
Yeah.
Also
So
known
yeah,
as a
and
Captain.
so though the thing about those made for TV ones is often they oftentimes they're more adventure or disaster movies but then 'cause horror movies were kind of popular, they were repackaged as horror movies, and most people w when they rent a horror mo a movie, they think it's horror and they don't really get horror. Those people are usually disappointed, but we were delighted by it because it was you got something bright and fun instead of something like dark and gloomy. And I think Manch Vegas definitely is a nod to that, in that like murder is in the title. But it's still a very sunny and cheery movie, and especially like as opposed to Freaky Farley, which goes a little bit darker into the slasher form.
And that's interesting because your Freaky Farley and Manch Vegas, especially Freaky Farley, as you said, has this kind of dark undercurrent. Like Freaky Farley himself is a peeping Tom. Manch Vegas does revolve around a dad killing multiple women due to some psychosexual stuff with his daughter. But they're also very there's not a really it's not really exploitation quality to your work for the most part. Is that come from like is that an intentional kind of sweetening up of the material or is I guess what from these movies are you pulling into your own work? Like what from this space you were so into were it was influencing you in that way?
We like the horror movies, but it's we really like just like the threat of horror that's kind of on the periphery of the movie while the characters are engaged in their normal lives. Those are our favorite parts of these movies, more so
Yeah.
than like the gore or the killing. And just more and more we've just decided to hang out in that world. You know, the boring scenes between the action, that's where we love to hang out.
I'd say in Manch Vegas, yeah. I mean, there's Marshall and Jenny, there's a lot of relationship stuff that's more like something you would see from Snow Beast. We were influenced a little bit by movie called Starburst, it's known as, with Robert Englund, and there's another t Slash Dreams. We were influenced by that, but the parts that most influenced were the lead up to the scary parts, where the young people are hanging out and there's like, you know, drama relationship kind of stuff. But I do think, yeah, that you know, the gore era of the 80s didn't really influence me very much. I was kind of scared of those movies when I was a little kid. And it's a little bit, it's a different discipline to film realistic looking gore as like a one-off like kill scene or something, or to write an entire movie that really is engrossing for people on a like narrative and emotional level through the 90 minutes, you know? So I think that's true. And then I will also say that we watched these movies with our families. We liked having both of those movies had premieres where we could feel pretty confident that most everybody wouldn't be too upset by it, except for maybe the tiniest young kids. But more or less, it was like, here's our movie. We're just having a fun time. We want you to be a part of it. We don't want you to feel bad. And for me, I always like helped program movies at my house. My mom would say, pick a movie. You're in charge. You're on the entertainment committee. And like my grandma will be there, or like I'm not gonna put on something really harrowing. I might put on something that's, you know, like if you're watching The Birds, we would all watch The Birds and we would enjoy the drama. And there's certainly super scary parts with The Birds, stuff like that. But there's a lot of good real movie stuff too. And that relationship stuff is we definitely enjoyed filming that in Manch Vegas. There's a lot of not just Marshall and Jenny, but the whole thing, like tensions of feeling that you got to grow up, and then, you know, jealousy from the outlaw Southcott's Outlaw Society. And
It's funny you mentioned The Birds as that example because I watched The Birds like last year and I thought it was like very, very disturbing. Like
oh, okay.
I was like, this movie is really messed up. So, but I noticed that because the first half of it is just like a very strange relationship drama, right? It's just like we're hanging out with Tippi Hedren and we're going around. Definitely has hangout qualities, and I definitely associate your films with the perfect hangout vibe. You know, it's like all these old horror movies, all the kind of the downtime, but like very well written and very intentionally done. All right, so now another question about Manch Vegas is, especially compared to Freaky Farley, it's a really big movie. There's a lot of plots going on. There's the monsters, the murder, the marriage. What was the writing process like? And then also, how did the shoots compare in terms of scale?
Okay, so for writing at early on, I had an idea for like at least three movies, maybe four. It was Monsters in Manch Vegas would be a whole movie, Murder in Manch Vegas, another movie. Then there was Mayhem in Manch Vegas and Marriage in Manch Vegas, and they were all going to be intersecting, you know, all four of them at work with as a you know, connected to each other, blah blah blah. Way too ambitious. And so then we decided let's jam the best of all these ideas into one movie. And so we ended up with this like very plot heavy, character heavy movie, way more ambitious in that way than Freaky Farley, which Freaky Farley is just a lot of scenes with me either alone or with just one or two other people, whereas Match Vegas is huge. And it was very, very ambitious to make. It involved just like trying to deal with, the schedules and time of all these people who are not professional actors and not being paid, and doing it all within a window. Like Charlie flew, he lived on the other side of the country at this point, and so he flew to New Hampshire, and basically, what, for 2.5 weeks, he lived in my studio apartment with me. And all we did for those 2.5 weeks was film absolutely everything we needed for the movie. And so it's we and we're dealing with bad weather and actors canceling on us and just the camera breaking at one point. But we were it was just like dealing with problems and putting out fires and making changes as we were going. But it was just like, well, we have to have it done before Charlie has to fly home, which is a good way to do it, I think.
Yeah. I would say too that we didn't have, there's no budget per se. There's no piece of paper that says you could spend this much on food and this much on costumes. Farley went to the local sports shop and got the Manch Vegas jerseys, and we could barely, there's, I guess you had an extra, a spare one of each, Farley. There wasn't a lot of them, but it's like making do with what you got. But one thing we did do that I think some small movies don't do is seek out interesting locations. And it was hard work to get everybody up on top of that rock where McGee is, not giving any spoilers, but like there's parts in the woods, especially the parts with the students in the deep woods. I mean, imagine asking your friend or neighbor who might not be into hiking to even like, hey, you want to go hang out in the woods or go on like a 2 an hour hike or something? They might be like, no, I don't do that. It's muddy and there's bugs. Like, well, you want to go spend like 6 hours in the woods where there's no chair. You have like a bottle of water and like a jar of peanuts to keep you going. And we're just, stacks of film, camera, and that's it. So, yeah, I mean, I think, I'm happy that we filmed all those places because some of them I might even have changed. Although Manch Vegas has a timeless quality to it, that town, pleasantly, not too much has radically changed, but we did kind of like go out of our way to get the charming bits, charming locales.
And we should point out it's technically Manchester, New Hampshire. That is the name of the city where I lived for 10 years after college, but its nickname is Manch Vegas. And as soon as we learned about this, like anytime Charlie and Tom would come and hang out for a weekend and stuff, just like learning more and more about the lore of this city. And we definitely like the idea of like writing a movie that totally glorifies this just random city in the middle of New Hampshire that's most people don't think much of, but like it's cool to just treat it like it's this epic place.
Yeah, like a real movie in California would have a beach party scene, but we have a river party.
River parties,
And the
yeah.
river party is at the whims of how high the water is in that river, but it's like a place for random folks to hang out under the train bridge.
Yeah.
So it's not Malibu.
Can y'all talk a bit more about Manchester? Knoxville, where I grew up, also is sometimes known as Knox Vegas, but has a different vibe than Manch Vegas. But because yeah, as you said in the intro as well, you're trying to show off this specific town. And can you just describe the town a bit more? Like, what's its energy like?
So yeah, I moved to Manchester, New Hampshire after college. I had grown up about an hour away from there, and I'd never been there before. I just after graduating college, I just thought I want to move someplace I've never been before, so I got a job there and an apartment, and Charlie would come up to hang out, or we'd go on long walks and kind of explore the area, and it was just great. Like, it's like a 9 to 5 work week city. So there's like hustle and bustle going around Monday through Friday during working hours, but then it gets real quiet in the evenings and on weekends, to the point where we realized like we can just film. We have like it felt like a back lot all to ourselves. We could just film scenes all over the downtown area. Nobody cared. No, very few people noticed us. And it was very good. And then another cool thing about Manchester is like it's got a downtown area, but you can drive 10 minutes in any direction, and then you're out in the country. So there's a little bit of suburban area, then it's woods, and then farmland, really quick. So it's like we had access to so many different locations, but all close to each other.
And I will say it has the town itself, totally everything Farley said. It's like a little backlot. And we were able to just go to a river, film river scenes, which is 5 minutes away from an all-American main street. And then we can go to the woods that have the overlook of the town. So it's all kind of right there. But personality-wise, there's like a ragtag spirit there where I think everyone there knows they don't live somewhere fancy or famous. It's just like if you want to be into comedy, like a lot of the comedy people probably knows, or a band, or make a movie, or be a poet, or do something creative. There are people like that. They are doing it, and they're just trying to find like little weird places where they can collaborate and do stuff. So I feel like there's sort of a it really fits for Manch Vegas, the movie, having these old like characters who are trying to just make the best of their situation and like celebrate the small things and
Yeah,
enjoy
it's got
life.
a spirit. Yeah, there's a spirit to the city for real.
Yeah, and there's a lot of like non-chain little like pizza shops, and like there used to be a weird bookstore downtown, and there was a lot of stuff where I think maybe especially when we were filming our movies, the rent was less. And people who had weird shops could kind of fall through the cracks and like keep their store open. So there was a couple vintage things like that where you're like, wow, this town is like trapped in time. And there's another town near there called Hooksett that we filmed a lot of Freaky Farley in, where it's just, again, trapped in time. Beautiful old brick buildings. There's no McDonald's right there or anything like that. It's just if you took a picture and held it up from 75 years ago, it'd probably look pretty similar.
And the movie's definitely, I mean, even after them on 16 mil, now you've kind of, I feel like, transferred this timeless quality to the movies. Also also just capturing autumn on screen. That's such like a crystalline thing you can do. The movies are so beautiful in the falling leaves. All right, I've got two more questions on Manch Vegas. So one, just quickly, this movie is unusual for y'all in that you cast someone who from Craigslist, I believe, Marie Delicker, right? And can you just talk about casting her, how that process worked out, and also have you ever cast anyone this way again?
Yeah, well, we cast in Freaky Farley, Steph, who plays the witch. We got her on Craigslist, and then Ruth, who
Timson.
plays Mrs. Timson, she was Craigslist. And it's because early on we didn't have that many people to choose from. We didn't know like we've slowly like amassed a almost like a troop of people who we know that they're reliable and we know they like doing it. But early on, we didn't have so many people, and so we just were for a few roles we were using Craigslist, and it was really hit or miss. But we hit with Marie, and she had just graduated college, and just figured, hey, I want to try something cool this summer. And we never met until the first day of filming, and we filmed with her 4 days in a row, and she was great. She brought a lot of energy to it. And basically we worked her real hard, but we tried not to work her so hard that she wouldn't come back the next day. But every morning of the next 3 days, we'd be sitting there being like, I hope Marie shows up today. And she always did. And it worked out great.
Yeah, I mean, she was indoctrinated, I guess, by our filmmaking style, but you got to be a little crazy to make a movie. and people who are used to just regular, like not waking up incredibly early and not going to bed completely exhausted and not having like film equipment and props all over the freaking floor in the living room and stuff and having a messy car. Like we had all that stuff going on for 4 days in a row. And it was, you know, it was joy that it was summer, but it was also really hot filming. And, you know, as Farley's tan during the movie can attest, we were all getting a lot of sun. But Marie was complete all-star, like gold, unbelievably dedicated, and like some of the best, you know, there's a lot of great scenes with her. But when she and Farley are having their like dramatic scenes, I was kind of like, holy cow, she's doing, these guys are, she and Farley are doing so good. This is amazing. We found her on Craigslist and she's just all in and willing to just do a creative project just because, you know. And you know, hey, now she's been in a movie, you know, which is really cool.
You know, it's inspiring. Just getting into the movie zone, getting into the acting zone. All right, my last question on Match Vegas for now is okay. It's been a hot minute since you all made this movie. How do you feel about it in retrospect, like in the kind of greater scheme of y'all's filmography and your lives? Like, we don't have to go like full Vonnegut, like give it like a letter rating, but just yeah. What are your thoughts on it in retrospect?
So happy that we did it. My advice to people is when you're, especially when you're young, if there's any chance that you can get a movie in the can and make the movie, you gotta freaking do it. You gotta do it. It's gonna get harder as you get more life responsibilities and stuff. So, I mean, all sorts of stuff was happening to us. There were people who were supposed to film on that morning multiple times and would tell us that they couldn't do it. It's not, I don't think it's, you know, one lady, one person did get hives apparently on the morning we were supposed to shoot. So maybe they had hives. Maybe they just didn't feel like doing it. Maybe it was too ambitious to say yes. But imagine that you're on location where you're supposed to be filming the scenes and someone texts you and says, I'm not coming. You know, and all you have is this amount of time to do it, and you already have the other person who they're acting with booked. So you just kind of have to like keep plowing ahead. But I am happy very much that we got this like fun movie in the can and captured all these nice people, a lot that Farley worked with. You know, once you've made a movie with somebody like we did with Marie, or you know, just working with John Noble and other people in Manchester, it's like you're kind of like friends for life in a way. Or even if you film with them for a week, it's like you've known them for a few years because it's so intense. And then when you're editing and watching it back, you know them well because you're spending time with them, you know, in movie terms and in real life, like high emotional terms where you know you got to deliver. And it's super cool. And I'm so happy also that we filmed it on film because it's harder to get film now. At that time, Farley could probably talk to it, but we had an account at Fuji. There was a guy who was helping us. So Farley, I'd be like, you know, we need some more film. And Farley, hey, or we would send an email to him, and then it would show up. We would be on the, you know, looking out the door and see if FedEx like delivered a big box of film, these 100-foot, you know, reels of Super 16. So I think it's cool to, give New England a little like sliver of time in the regional film world. Sorry if I rambled there.
Yeah, and for me, it's kind of th this movie is sort of. All our movies are under the radar, but Manch Vegas even more so than some of our other, like Freaky Farley's got twice, I just looked it up, twice as many people have viewed Freaky Farley on Letterboxd. And I think in part it's because like it's hard to classify Manch Vegas. Like, is it a comedy, a mystery, a horror, a thriller? Like, yes, all of those things. So it's cool. It's cool to have like these movies that people think they know our stuff, and then they're like, oh, there's this other one, Manch Vegas, I haven't heard about, and they might put it on. It's nothing that a viewer can really prepare themselves for. Like, there's so much going on, and it's just so bright and fun that it's fun to imagine a person discovering it like that. So, like Charlie said, it's It's great we did it, because what else would we have been doing during those 2.5 weeks of filming? You know, we would have had 2.5 completely unmemorable weeks versus now we have a finished work of art.
It's interesting what you're just saying about, sorry, my phone alarm just went off, but it's about saying the Manfagus being so hard to classify. When I was thinking of what to program for this, I had a big debate with my with some local other fans. We were all talking around like an hour just talking about which of your films to program for the double. And we ended up on Manfagus and Boss and Johnny because, yeah, we felt like we're a little bit more under the radar and kind of showcased these other qualities of y'all's, especially Manfagus, because it has everything. It's got more serious parts, and it's got the totally goofy parts, and it's got the spooky parts. I really hope that, I think it also, I hope that if we get some people in the crowd who are not who are coming in from other films, who are not already super into y'all, then this will be a good starting point to just give them a taste of potentially everything on your palates.
Yeah, and I think it's like Boston Johnny is our Manch Vegas of this era of our movies, you know, like in that it's just like this weird over the top comedic light outlier compared to all the movies around it.
And great transition into Boss and Johnny. So, okay, first I want to start with just Matt. This Boss and Johnny is one of your most dastardly characters. So can y'all just talk about the conception of this guy? How did you come to be like, we're going to create the most despicable man in any of our movies?
So Charlie had an idea for like it'd be cool if there was a character who was doing a bad job in like a kind of like a formal video presentation scenario. That was what Charlie came at it with. And I had always had an idea for a character who stole a dog and that they had to have like a moment where the dog got to choose who it went to. So we met with those two ideas and we're like, okay, what can we do? How can we make this go together? And so soon it became, okay, Boston Johnny is an ad man, you know, where he delivers ad reads for products. And then at one point he's a dog comes to his door and he just takes the dog. And then we just kept going with it, kind of like, all right, what else would happen? And like I said, I think at one point, well, we had totally forgotten about the concept of saying no to any idea. Like, you know, this was like our fourth or fifth movie in 2 or 3 years. So just like, yeah, what if this happens next? Yeah, good, let's do that. But it was fun for Boston Johnny just to be a total jerk, but for him to think he's like the hero, and frankly, for the movie to treat him as the hero pretty much, you know? So it was fun to do that. And the voice. We were like, all right, Pee Wee Herman does a movie in a weird voice. We should do that. And I don't think I ever really settled on what the Boston Johnny voice would be, because it very much fluctuates from scene to scene, if not line to line, frankly.
But that's okay, because you had the jacket. I mean, you had the jacket, you had the moves
I
down.
had the mood. I was good with the like in my I was like, Boston Johnny's always hearing that beat in his head. Boston Johnny, you know, Boston
Yeah,
Johnny, like
I think the audience, it's like kind of a treat for them to have to put themselves into an alternate reality where this man can like pay bills and have a house and go around and live and stuff.
lives on
And
in a screened-in deck too. I like that.
yeah, so it's like this cartoony escapism that you could get. And also, I think there's a funny tradition of ad people. And Kai, you might know like Crazy Eddie on the East Coast. And there's other people like that. And, you know, like the Where's the Beef commercial or stuff in advertising where the weirdest stuff just gets famous somehow, or it just becomes a trend. And I thought, you know, I think when we were writing it, we thought, well, yeah, Boston Johnny will become popular with like the teens, like in the story. It's like that's the kind of thing that, you know, could almost happen because the teens, they're open-minded and they like someone wacky who stands for them or is like, you know, not totally in line with all the regular norms of adulthood. But yeah, it was very funny, and Tom gets to play our buddy Tom Scalzo gets to play a dignified man too, which was great. And was this the first one? Well, this is the tradition, Farley, of where we let some people name characters.
Right. Yeah, yeah,
So
yeah. It was one of them. Yeah.
but that's
That's
also
how
Romano's
we get.
own Will Sloan.
Correct. Yes.
Correct. Yeah. So that was funny. And Tom kind of got to play it as if he were like a Bogdanovich. That's part of the reason he wears the scarf thing. And also, I had a scarf and we didn't have to buy one. So both those issues.
Yeah, the best part though was each time we filmed with a new actor and that actor would hear me deliver a line as Boston Johnny, every time they'd be like, "Oh." Oh, so that's how you are for the whole movie? And we're like, "Yep, that's right."
Yeah, people might have said that to Ernest back in the day. Ernest P.
Yeah,
Worrell.
he was
Yeah,
right, and so were we.
Pee-wee
No one
too.
ever said that to Sandler, and he gets to do that all the time. So,
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, I think that's the fun escapism of something. And there's absolutely no, like, we knew that we're not going to get brownie points with anybody or anything for this. It's just fun. Like, what if you made a movie that was just fun? Not only do you know you're not going to get brownie points, you know you're going to get teased or critiqued hard, maybe. So, I don't really read any reviews, I'm going to say, and in all honesty. But we've never formally been reviewed, as far as I know, in like a trade or anything other than Shock Cinema Magazine, I think. And
I
I mean,
read all the reviews. I'd just like
those
to
are just
point.
like pe those are just like people, like which is great, but it's not
That's
like,
better.
yeah, that's better, but it's not like a review from a thing. Like, it's our job to do it. Like, if people do press junkets and they've got to like be familiar with the reviews or something.
I'd like to also point out, I love press conferences, and I was very happy that we could work the concept of a press conference into the movie, and where Boston Johnny's just having these press
Yeah.
conference dreams. And it's like it's a fun comedic thing that you can really have a lot of good back and forth. And then it's a good way to get lots of other like lines for actors, people who want to have a cameo, just put them in a chair, have them say a line. It's pretty painless for them, and it's fun. I mean, much like Manch Vegas, Boston Johnny, big cast, big plot, lots going on.
You should say, Farley, about how you were at your extravaganza concert when we were. So, I mean, having an extravaganza concert is like insane enough, very, very
Yeah.
busy. But speaking of those press conferences, there was one, one day when we're in this hall in New Hampshire and everybody's there. So we, designed the script that's the day that we filmed the press conference. So there's people from other countries and other many states. And
Yeah.
they get a
Yeah,
chance to be in the
we
movie.
told them come like it was the night we were premiering Magic Spot and we said come 2 hours before the premiere if you want to be in our next movie Boston Johnny. So all these people show up, we put them all in the chairs and then Charlie's getting them in the camera. We're going through all the lines they have to deliver while the staff at the place is really confused as to what we're doing. And but it's like anytime we know we're going to be in the presence of lots of people who like our movies, we're like, how can we get them in the movie? Because it's cool to see lots of different faces and crowds of people all in one shot.
Yeah, we did that in Metal Detector Maniac too, when everybody was around for an extravaganza and get, Peter Kaplowski and Gary up there performing a song in Farley's garage. But it worked out nicely.
Just going back a little bit, a tangent to talking about the ad man. Have y'all ever seen Cujo? Because I just read and watched Cujo, and it has an amazing guy. It's very similar to in terms of strange ad man characters. It's the, have you are y'all familiar
Oh.
with?
I've
There's
never seen it.
No, I'm too scared to watch Cujo.
fair enough. It is pretty scary, but there is a
Yeah.
subplot about one of the characters being like a small town ad guy, and they create a character called the Serial Professor, who is just like kind of a weird patrician authoritarian guy who's like, this cereal is good. Nothing wrong here. And I was thinking about Boston Johnny while watching it.
Wow. Never do that.
Yeah, the book has a
And
whole like
yeah.
page on it.
I mean, that's how Ernest got his start, I think, too, right, Charlie? Like being
Yeah.
a local ad man. And I think
Max Headroom too. That's kind of a similar thing.
Okay, cool.
I think, yeah, more ad people should do stuff like that. Instead of like being cool in their ads, they should be like just like a weird person is much more fun to watch than like some
Yeah.
cool 30-second
A lot of
spot.
furniture stores, Bargain Bernie is famous for
Yeah.
that. There's all these
Yeah.
people who are like, well, I'll be it. There's famous used car people.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. It lets like the average person be a star. And
Right.
that's kind
And
of like Boston Johnny, you know?
local celebrities in general, like it's cooler for there to be like these people that are only known in a certain region.
Yeah.
Matt, can you talk about making the very, I'm going to use the word infectious theme song for Boston Johnny?
Yeah, well, it way before I recorded it, we had kind of talked about how it would just be like a really basic like synth drum beat, you know, with Boston Johnny going over it. And it's just like as we're writing the script, even as far back as that, it was like, oh, we could have a little almost like that 70s show, how they had those weird like interstitial things. Is that the right word, Charlie?
Sure. Or Seinfeld even too, maybe.
Yeah, but yeah, that whole thing, like just like a way to transition you from one scene to the next. Like the song comes on, you see Boston Johnny walking on the sidewalk, and it just keeps the momentum of the movie going.
Yeah, I think Farley did a great job to come up with that catchy song and have it in mind while acting and stuff too. So it's like it just led this fun. This fun vibe of a guy who's dancing through life and doesn't have all the regular, like, doesn't deal with the regular rules and worries that everyone else does. And I think because he's so out there, you know, you're saying how he's a little bit of a despicable type guy, he does wild stuff. You don't take it that seriously because, you know, he's living in a screened-in deck, and he doesn't even like, you know, he's getting paid, and then he's fam like, he doesn't, you know, how is he balancing a checkbook and showing up on time? He's got an agent, you know, it's just like this less complicated world. Oh, wow, the pup.
Yeah, I still have the plush Pippi pet right here. Just wanted to show you.
Better than Pippi. Yeah, and it's also, I feel like the theme song also, because it's so catchy, and like, I mean, I'm still from watching the other day, I'm still in my head again. Like, I feel like it puts us into Boston Johnny's mindset. We're like, yeah, this guy, like, we get it. We're singing the song along with him, the song of his life. Okay, so I'll use that to bounce. I'll use the stuffed dog to bounce onto, like, a kind of quick question here, which is,
Oh,
well,
hang on. Wait, I just want to introduce you guys. Here's Pippi
actual
right here,
Pippi.
one
This
of
is
the stars of the movie.
so I wanted to ask, what is Pippi like off screen, and what was dealing with an animal on set like?
Well, off screen, Pippi is her goal in life is to annoy me. And
Very
she
successful.
barks. She barks at inopportune times. And we've trained her to ring a bell when she needs to go outside, and she uses it vindictively. If she's annoyed with me, she'll ring the bell c just to bother me. So it's kind of we clash a little bit, me and Pippi, but I'm not joking, and Charlie can attest, she's good at acting. I'm not joking at all. It really seems like Pippi knows. She's like, all right, we're doing something here, and I have got to deliver. Charlie, take it from there. Like, she
Yeah,
delivered.
she's kind of a diva and in a good way, you know. But yeah, she's run around for us. She's kind of sat still for us. She has that a lot of intelligence about her. When she's not in the scene, though, it seemed like there was a run of all of our movies where everyone was coming in Farley's front door.
Oh,
There are
yeah.
many scenes by that front door, and every time
Every
someone
time.
knocked or opened the door, she barked like crazy. So it was almost like, you gotta stop writing scenes that are gonna annoy
Yeah.
Pippi. Like,
So
how can we?
sometimes, yeah, sometimes Charlie's trying to film the scene and there's no one there to keep Pippi quiet. So in the other hand, he's holding Pippi and like almost muzzling her as he's trying
Oh,
to film.
cuddling. Yeah, just
Cut.
cuddling. They
We'll
can't let
say
her
cuddling, but
be
yeah.
part of the scenario. But yeah, no, she did a good job, and it was funny. It was rare, Farley, you could probably speak to this, but it was rare for her to be out of her house or yard for the duel for a doggy. Very rare, right?
Yeah, and she had a heck of a good time. We brought her to the park, and she was happy. She liked Sleason, and she was very responsive to what we needed her to do. And so, and another thing, just since we've had Pippi's been around since Slingshot Cops. I'm sure there are scenes throughout all the movies where just that quiet little rattling of whatever is on her collar, just in scenes where her character shouldn't be there and isn't on screen, she just moved a little bit. She's like, "Oh, I can interrupt this scene if I do this," and she'll do it.
She definitely has like a Rin Tin Tin quality to her, that kind of Hollywood dog charisma. I definitely see it. I'm glad.
Yeah, and a great name. Just Pippi's a great name for her. It really fits her personality.
Yeah, I do think the Pippi's choice, one of the funniest scenes y'all have ever done.
Tool for a doggy, yeah.
I was watching that by myself the other night, and I was laughing just to my computer. It's delightful. Okay, I got my next question is okay, the true heads are gonna want me to ask, gotta make sure I ask about Kevin McGee. His line reading in Bossajani of, I'm gonna try to kind of imitate it a little bit. I was aloof with a woman. And I think one of the reasons his performance is so funny in this movie in particular is that it is just like played pretty straight. Like there is a serious like regret and romance in him while also wearing that ridiculous wig. So can you just talk about working with Kevin McGee on this project, and also just how has your working relationship with him evolved over the years?
Well, Farley should really talk first on this. I'll go quickly, but because Farley knows McGee through his work, and I was just lucky enough to meet McGee through Farley. But I mean, we've been working together for over, I guess, 20 years, over 20 years, and it hasn't really evolved that much, and that's a good thing because he's still on board. I think we're all able to have that sort of young people, let's do a thing and not sweat it too much mentality. He's open-minded to wearing a costume and thinking creatively. That was his idea to wear the Boston Johnny outfit. But because we're collaborating with him, he's like, "Charlie, Matt, I've been thinking I'm gonna wear this. I got something, I'm gonna wear it." And he did the same with Evil Puddle. So when you collaborate with someone like that, it's like they're putting their flavor into the movie, which is fantastic, and I really, respect that and like that. And he is an excellent, serious actor, and he's great at pretty much everything, as you'll probably tell. He can, sports wise and acting wise and dancing and singing. But he never tried to do it si silly. There is that regret because he's like, "I'm gonna make this a big dramatic moment," and he sometimes asks for another take, which really no one else does, but he might have had, "I could do it a little better," and because he's into it. So we work with everybody with what they want to give us. If someone's like, "I'm only going to do it once," then we're only getting it once. But Kevin is like a real perfectionist, and he's fantastic. We show up at his house, we try to make it easy for him. We film out in his yard generally, so we're not breaking anything inside, and he just delivers, he's a consummate professional at everything he does.
Yeah, and he'll go the extra mile. When we show up, he's got the fire burning in the fire pit, like he's prepared. He's already dressed in his outfit. He's been rehearsing his lines, and it's just great, so I just happened to meet, work with him at my first job out of college, and I quickly recognized that he was interested in stuff like this. And if you meet a person who's fine filming for 6 hours, like a silly, ridiculous movie, then you have to hold on to that person, and we absolutely have. And for us, it was cool because we were like, 22, 23 years old, and he was in his 40s, and so it like added some gravitas to our productions to have like a grown adult who on paper, had better things to do, was willing to put time and effort into these projects, and here we are 25 years later still doing it.
And I'll say, like, how many people have, there are people in this world who have fantastic talent but don't have an outlet because they don't have a friend who's making a movie or putting on a play or playing in a band and says, "Hey, come try to play drums with me," or "Come, write a song with me," or something, or heck, any artwork. Let's have drawing hours, stuff like that. But I think because we're doing it and the momentum's going, he can show up and contribute. I would say same about Sharon. Sharon Scalzo is unbelievably talented actor. She had never been in anything, as far as I know,
So
other than
confident.
maybe. Yeah, just never been in anything. And she was like, I could do that. I'll be in one of your guys' movies. And, we said yes. And then it was fantastic every time. So she's kind of just like a real natural and, fantastic as well. But she, didn't really have an outlet. And so the outlet is us, and we're finishing movies. So it doesn't feel like, oh, I'm going to go film with these guys and it's not going to come out. It's like, well, it's coming out. There's going to be a premiere. And, come out and have fun and watch it,
Also on Chan, I just want to say, like, back to Manch Vegas, she totally sells the romance with the I've forgotten the name of the creature, but it's amazing that I'm like watching it. I'm going like, yeah, I'm really rooting for them. And I'm like, that's her just her face.
That was the intent, was to like secretly people are watching it like, wait, I'm into this movie, like where many you may maybe many a low no budget movie you're not really invested emotionally, but we hope that sneaky sneak up on you and get you, yeah,
You
engrossed.
told her, because a lot of these, we're talking about all these 16 millimeter movies, these regional movies, and like I love a lot of these movies. I really like the shot on video era, but I do watch them, not like I'm not like immersed in them exactly. Like I'm appreciating them as objects and as kind of these snapshots of time, right? But I do really feel like your movies, by the end of all of them so far that I've seen, maybe not Obtuse Todd, although I do really like that one as well. But like I'm into it, I'm like invested in the characters, and I'm hoping that they go well, or their comeuppance happens. It's really wonderful that you're able to kind of have it kind of both ways, as it were.
Well, let me just say, yeah, like in my music, well, sometimes what I say, like I think my secret weapon is that my songwriting abilities are kind of above the subject matter of the song, sort of. Like most people wouldn't put this quality, this level of songwriting work and skill into a toilet humor song, And likewise, I think our filmmaking abilities are, most people would take them and put them into I don't know what, but something that's more highly respected than like a backyard monster movie. And so I think that's our secret weapon, is that we bring whatever B plus level talent to like D minus level content.
Yeah, we've watched a lot of boring movies in our day too. And so there's somewhere where we, Farley Tom and I would look at each other and be like, oh my God, this movie's still got this much time left in it, or this one's pretty boring. Random ones that we would find on the VHS rental rack. So it kind of like builds up in you this thing to, okay, let's not do that necessarily. But I will say, some of those very meandering ones, if your mood is that way that day, go for it too. So, I occasionally have put something like that on an October Saturday when I'm in the Halloween mood and it's just something that's on in the background. Those can be cool too. But we're a little hyper focused on things paying off and the characters being, really fun, stuff like that.
Well, this is one of the reasons your movies aren't pastiches, right? Because like those movies are boring, and I say that with love. I love being bored in a movie like that. I love hanging out in the living room for 15 minutes while people kind of just like riff on small talk, but your films are always moving, and they're always got they have some of these hangout qualities while still just having this kind of pulling us through the film, All right, my last question on Boss and Johnny, and then I have a few kind of more broader questions to wrap this up, is Manch Vegas, and for you, probably shot at 16, and that now we're deep into your digital era. And I want you to talk about shooting on digital, and Charlie in particular. Like, I really love the look of your black and white digital movies. I think they look really fantastic, and I just want you to talk about kind of how you approach the visuals, how you approach the style.
Well, I think I like the black and white for Boss and Johnny especially, because it seems like it would be something that's an art movie. But there, in all honesty, there's not a lot of secret there. It's more it's and Boss and Johnny, he had a very iconic jacket, which I think is nice in black and white. I think he's he reads very well, but I would say that it's there's not a lot of secret there with the look. It's keeping things in the cartoony style. You try to keep it broad and like have it read quickly. I think we usually do that, but also we're not having so the woods will give you that very simplistic sets will give you that. But in general, we don't, there's no production designer. We're not building anything usually. So it's kind of what's there is there. We don't have a lot of lights. A lot of it is done with reflectors. And, it's if we have a helper there that day, sometimes it's Jay Mayo, sometimes it's Tom. We try to work with the natural light. It helps us go faster. And also, since we can't afford lights and don't have them, that works out well. But yeah, I don't know. I think we just try to keep it simple and not too overly done, because it would kind of be a contradiction in terms, I think, if this, we're trying to make a charming little fun to watch movie. Don't be too fancy.
Yeah, but also I think Boston Johnny is beautiful, and like every shot is I don't know, like it felt like the sweet spot for that camera too. Like Charlie had made a couple movies on that camera and it was still working well. And so like of the movies we made with that Canon, that's the one where it's like, oh, it's not quite malfunctioning yet, and Charlie's figured out what all the buttons can do, and it's like, oh, this is so, and it's funny, like for this black and white, like feeling like a French new wave black and white movie look, and versus what the movie the what the content is, and that's a fun juxtaposition, if you will.
Ooh,
Thank
nice
you.
word. Yeah, there's a little, I think when we were talking to Will and Justin, we might have said this too, but there's a little bit of like a mock epic type thing where, especially with Duel for a Doggy, where we're trying to we're shooting these two guys like they're NFL stars, like or like some kind of celebrities on the try to get like some wide shots and try to get them like staring down the lens, and it feels like these lovable regional characters are portrayed as if it were like a celebrity contest or something with Tom Brady, or I don't know. It's just like that mock epic of giving the little guy his moment.
But then you can also turn it on for like, for instance, Heard She Got Murdered. That movie like doesn't feel mock epic. It does feel epic, especially some of the shots of the power lines. I guess this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, like choosing location and really leaning into that, because I think that movie is like often really overwhelmingly like aesthetically to me.
Yeah, I
You're
think a
saying
lot
Heard
of.
She Got Married, right? You
Yes, Heard She
mean
Got Married.
Mary?
Sorry, not murdered, married. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of those were when there's shots where it's just Farley or and it's me and Farley filming, we have a little more time with the camera, and I think that a lot of those outside scenes kind of by the power lines were sort of that way, where I'm like, scrambling over rocks and trying to like shout up the hill like, hey, and
Do this, yeah.
yeah, it's harder when you've got a lot of people around who need to go home. We work with what we got, but that was a very solitary movie for Farley. And in the shots where he's walking around with his headphones, his character, we were able to just go, just us two, and go around to different parks and try to get some interesting framings. And just like, it's a different feeling in your heart when when it's just us, because we know we're not really bothering anybody. I mean, my wife might be like, oh, when's he gonna come home to do these chores and stuff? But other than that, it's very freeing to know that no one is really, we're not really inconveniencing anybody, because we're all in on making movies for so many years that it just feels like, oh yeah, we're getting interesting shots.
In the Motrin on Motrin book, Matt, I think is you who write. You talk about this philosophy of like anti-perfectionism. And is this something you A, do you still have this, and do you both kind of share this thinking about your work?
Yeah, I mean, I think I err a little bit more on the who cares side of things than Charlie. Like Charlie will be like, ah, let's put in a little bit extra effort to get it to look nice, and I'll just be like, ah, who cares? Like in Manch Vegas, I remember like the food on the table and the scene where McGee's eating at a plate, and it was McGee was like, "Should I put some food on this plate so I'm actually eating something?" And I was like, "Yeah, who cares?" And Charlie was like, "Yeah, go to your kitchen and grab three items of food, put it on the plate, you know?" And Charlie was right in that situation, but in my head, I was just like, "Yeah, that's 2 minutes. It's 2 minutes of McGee getting up, going to his kitchen and going to the fridge. Can we spare it?" We did spare it, but it basically that's the measurements you're always doing in your head. And it's good to have people on either side of that to like keep it even, 'cause if you go too far in my who cares direction, then before you know it, the movie is just complete garbage.
There's always a balance. I mean, you could probably look at the history of especially Roger Corman movies. You go really pushing it with the terror to the point where it's like you can't understand what's happening almost. And then maybe getting up more towards the 80s, getting towards like something like Humanoids from the Deep or Piranha type things where you're like, oh wow, now it's like it's low budget, but it's more a little bit more like a regular movie. But yeah, there's always a balance. But we do have to be careful when we film in other people's house too, like in McGee's. We don't want to move stuff. So if he's got family portraits on the wall and things like that, we're not gonna say, hey, we're gonna redo your room to film this like, one scene. It's just,
Yeah.
it is what it is. You know, it's like a moral obligation to us to not inconvenience him.
Yeah. Now, on the flip side, you said how what are our thoughts now, and the movie we're writing right now, Evil Spot. Currently, the approach we've been saying let's do almost the opposite of our approach, where instead of trying to get five scenes done in an afternoon, let's spend one entire day on one scene or one shot or whatever, to the point where we're expecting Evil Spot to take like 2 years to shoot and release. And so every scene we're writing, we're thinking about what we can do visually in terms of the camera moving, in terms of scenes with no cuts. Like, what if we could do like Hitchcock's Rope? You know, what if there's like a 3 minute scene with a moving camera and multiple actors, and we don't even do any cuts, and et cetera, just because it's like, all right, we've made a lot of movies in one style. We have a very small fan base, but let's shock them just when they've become accustomed to what we normally do. Let's give them something completely different from us. So look out.
Wow. I'm looking. I'm ready. I'm ready for the slower moving shoot for your next movie. Or your not next movie, the one after the one, right? So I also on this is a reminder of the scene of Boss and Johnny that I really love, which is when I believe it's you, Charlie, you're talking about the outdoor set with like the outdoor green screen, and you're basically just like, the vibe is great. We like shooting outside. We don't need the studio. It fits the space. It gives us more freedom to do stuff. It's again in this very silly movie, this scene that really like hits the heart of stuff, I think, really moves me.
Yeah, it's like the English guys are more fancy, and they're coming over and like making fun of our setup. So yeah, I mean it's definitely, I think Farley and I could put ourselves in the shoes of that character and both characters, and someone would tease us. But there's a lot of people who tease us who maybe haven't made a movie yet, and I'll be like, well, talk to me, talk to me in a few years or something, when we've done scenes where people who we'd already shot stuff, and then they're like, "I have to go." So what do you do then? Or someone's like, "I can film with you, but I have a haircut, or I do have." We've had barbecues. People have had. We've had scenes where on the day we had everyone there, but one person couldn't come. So even if you had planned out this whole thing to shoot this way, and you go here, well, that person's not here. So maybe that whole part of the room we're not going to see, and then we're going to have to try to keep in our heads, if we don't have a script supervisor or anything, how that person can interact with the rest of the room. But that's just what you got to roll with, because everyone's just doing it for fun. It's just, when you're doing it for fun and everyone's essentially doing a favor, it's kind of like, we're throwing a get together. Show up when you can, show up if you can. We're begging you to stay a little bit longer, but than just a normal get together, but we're gonna make a movie. And I don't know, that kind of plays into what we've been doing lately, where we only film with people from a morning to a lunchtime or after lunch to dinner time. So there's no, generally no break where we sit down and have a meal and everyone, get out of the vibe. And then they know that if they could just tough it out and do this like 9 a.m. to 12 or 12:30, they're going to have a decent part in the movie. And maybe we'll have to use them another day, another weekend, but it's this chunk of time that's very manageable for people. And I think that is a fun thing that we've sort of settled on lately. And I've filmed with people where we've been like, well, and Farley's done this too. He always treats us to sandwiches and things like that. But people will be like, well, do you want a sandwich or do you want to go home? And they'll be like, I just want to go home. Like it's so emotional making a movie, even if you've only been doing it that day for 3 hours, it almost feels like a whole day. And you're kind of like, ah, everyone decompresses. Although we have filmed sometimes all day with people, and then when it feels like they want to go home, but then when we yell cut and it's all over, they're kind of like want to chat for a little bit because it's this two different headspaces. It's like the intensity of filming and knowing that you got to be on, and then sort of the fun afterward feeling, knowing you have all that in the can, and then you can chat.
It's a great answer. Thank you. All right. So my next question is, we're screening your work at an underground film festival. Do you consider yourself underground filmmakers? And if so, what does that mean to you?
Underground. Yeah, I mean, we must be underground, 'cause I mean, where else? We're definitely not above ground. I know, in terms of like notoriety or success, we're down there. And it's cool, it's cool to be underground. That's, it's always like once people know about you, you're not cool anymore. And so we are cool. On the flip side, we have paid our dues, I'd say. We've been underground for 25 years. So I, for one, I'm ready. I'm ready to sell out and go overground. How about you, Charlie?
Yeah, sure. I would say in general, people need to wrap their head around the fact that like it's not done under the os none of the movies are done under the auspices of a university or a production company or something. I mean, really like that. We ain't got no auspices. It's just us, really. So there's not a flotilla of paperwork and insurance and yada yada yada, all that junk. There's no one involved with the movie who's not in the movie. I would say pretty much everyone, either if you're someone who's helping us behind the scenes, you are probably going to be at some point in front of the camera too, almost without exception. So it's really just having a get together and people come over and then like let's make something. And it's a great way to Farley often talks about this, and maybe you could run with it, but it's a great way to stay in contact with friends and people who you might not see all the time. But if you're like, hey, I got a role for you, it's not like, hey, let's just go to the mall, or like, I don't know, let's watch or just do something kind of random. It's a very specific hangout.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I reach out to people who I totally would have lost touch with, except, every 6 to 18 months, I got to be like, hey, I got a role for you, and it's great. And like I've gotten to know a lot of people that Charlie grew up with, Charlie's met a lot of people that I grew up with, and that's kind of cool. And again, it's hard to cross that barrier. You're like your high school friends, your college friends, but if you make a movie together, then those barriers go away. Yeah, so that's cool. And
And when people meet each other at like the extravaganza or at a premiere, it's like they're all part of this friendly group, Be like, hey,
Yeah, I
I know you
recognize
from
you.
I
Yeah.
recognize you. My buddy Kyle, he will be like, oh, you're such a jerk in River Beast or something,
Yeah,
So
Sparky Watts.
it's like your calling card when you show up. People know your face, and you're all part of this, like Farley said, a troupe or a collective that we're just like doing stuff together.
Yeah, and let me look one just one more thing, like in terms of like underground, it's a complete, like some people have said, like when they showed up for filming, they just assumed there'd be multiple people working behind the scenes, and it's like Charlie's doing the role of six people, and I'm doing the role of three people behind the scenes, plus I'm in the scene as an actor, and there's literally almost always nobody else doing anything behind the scenes, and so it's not what you expect when you think of movies like that, and frankly, I'm sure there's pros to having a team of people helping you behind the camera, but also there's cons, and one of the cons is it's just you're gonna organize deal with so many people versus we just kind of do it ourselves, and so it's like we don't have to explain here's what I need you to do for this, here's what I need you to do for this. No, we just do it all and go, and so it's much easier to see. To be responsible for the finished product, you know, good or bad, we definitely can't really blame it on anyone else.
It gets exponentially complicated the more people you have.
Yeah.
It's not just one person makes it a little. You get one and then two and then three other people there. They're wanting to chat is going to be, you know, amplified. And then you don't want to have this set thing. The thing that happens on real sets is there's sometimes someone who's there just for the job. Like they don't really want to be there. And then bad vibes are coming off them. And you don't want anybody there who's given off any bad vibes. Like we can't do that. So everybody is like happy and on point, happy to be there generally, you know. Yeah, and they know we're not going to take too much of their time. And I think that's you could see that by so many people coming back for so many movies. And if whoever can really has been able to, unless they moved away or something. But we're not just making one movie. I think that's a thing that people do in college, maybe. They push people too hard to the point where they get
They
mad and then
lose
they're,
friends.
yeah, here's, we're not doing that. I mean, people are the real important thing. And then like being nice and ethical to everybody. But also, we're not just making one movie, we're making 20 movies or something. So
So
we gotta.
we need them back. We need them to keep coming back.
Yeah, it's not all about this one shot being perfect, it's about this whole arc of movies.
It's very beautiful. And also y'all are in good company in terms of keeping the cruise low. I mean, Eric Rohmer, famous French director, right? He by the 80s, he'd had down to him, cinematographer, and sound. He got rid of the AD and he was working in the studio, you know? I think about that a lot when I'm watching your movies. I'm like, God, the Rohmer spirit, in a certain way, although y'all are funnier. My next question, I mean, also on this is you're talking about you're hoping that you eventually get above ground. Do you feel like y'all have, I feel like you've gotten much more known in the last few years. I'm seeing the horizon where y'all become more and more known. I hope this contributes a little bit to that because even think about y'all making The Paperboy back in 1999 and now people are still watching it. How have you, in terms of the arc of your filmmaking careers, do you feel that expansion? Am I talking out of my butt?
Yeah. No, I mean it's so much, it's leaps and bounds over what it was for our first 10 years out of college. I mean, like I said earlier, we were making the movies that not even the actors wanted to watch. Yeah, and what's hilarious is that it never dawned on us to stop making them in that scenario. And so yeah, and especially in the last 5 years, it's with Will and Justin writing a book about the movies, and them and Gold Ninja putting the movies on Blu-ray, it's to the point where thousands of people, if we put out a movie, we're sure several thousand people are gonna watch it in the first year that it came out, which is incredible, and exciting. And if we premiere a movie, people are going to travel from distances just to experience the official premiere. So, yeah, we've definitely come a long way. I mean, we're definitely not there yet in terms of we need more than thousands. We need how about several tens of thousands, and then maybe
Right.
it would lessen the burden financially, because it's easier to go to spend a weekend filming if you know you're not also going to lose, a few hundred dollars in the process of doing it, right, Charlie?
Yeah. I would say our movies are meant to be watched with a crowd as much as possible. And the micro cinemas that have opened up and sort of been a trend in the last few years have been very nice. The Spectacle showed a bunch of our movies in New York, and then this place called Spacey in Dallas, because we could get, a small room full of very dedicated people to watch it. That's kind of like the sweet spot of there's people who are really into it and really want to watch it, and there's other people who have no interest and don't want to watch anything that's like not a studio movie, but the people who are really into it are like ultra into it. So when you need those ultra into it people, put them in a micro cinema and enjoy up on screen, that's kind of like the sweet spot. And I also have been feeling that some young people are more open-minded to different filmmaking styles now. And maybe in the 90s into the early 2000s, everyone really, or a lot of people really wanted to mimic studio stuff more, like even with their studio student movies. And I think they're, I don't know, just a vibe I get. And some, like younger people I know, they seem to be very open to watching stuff that is, doesn't have to look a certain way. We've met some of them at the micro cinemas too. But yeah, our movies are always best with a crowd, I think. There's something fun about this charge of being like, wait, are these guys serious? And what's going on here? And oh my gosh, do you get that joke too? Or somebody sharing it with somebody who hasn't seen it yet and they're waiting to get to a certain beat and see how they react.
Yeah. And also, it's cool. Like at that screening in Dallas, people showed up with their DVD, Blu-ray copies of our movies so we could sign them and whatnot. And I mean, that would have been completely unheard of even 10 years ago, that happening. So, yeah, it's a bit of a slow process, but every year is better than the last in terms of, how many people are aware and appreciative of what we're doing. And so future's bright. We just gotta stay alive long enough to get fully above ground.
That's absolutely well. Well, my next question then, just which is well, actually, sorry, two things quickly. One, on the young people being kind of open to kind of different modes of filmmaking. I teach film studies at a university, and I've shown some pretty really low budget stuff to my students. And I have had students say to me like, "Oh yeah, that reminds me of like making movies on my iPad when I was 10 or whatever, and that's really fun." And like, I do think there is the access to technology. Matt, you said earlier, technology progress good. Like, it has opened up people to thinking about different kind of, I guess, expectations for what movies can be, which I think is nice. And then my last question before we kind of just wrap up with just a final like sentiment for me basically is, I mean, y'all have been making movies since 1999 or earlier than that. We've been talking about increased success to a certain level, but it is a lot of work, as we talked about. How do you keep the drive up? What is it that keeps y'all going?
There's nothing else I'd rather be doing, I love having a movie to work on. It's and I would feel like I was wasting my life if I wasn't engaged in a project, So it's just this is so much fun. It's great that I can text Charlie and be like, hey, what if this happened in the next movie? And Charlie will actually reply. That's wonderful. And the fact that like the screenings in Chicago's this screening in Australia in Brooklyn, it's going to be screening in London in a few months. The fact that these things are happening make it easier to keep doing it because it's like, oh, like we do actually have an audience, so we're not just making it for nobody like we did 20 years ago. So nothing else I'd rather be doing, and we have no intentions of stopping.
Yeah, super fun chatting with Farley and Tom, and getting Pete to, hey, what's your role for this next movie? We just, and he dives in and he does a great job, and everyone just kind of moves their lives around a little bit to make things work. But it's reached the point now where I think if we haven't talked to somebody in a few months, they kind of start to think like, oh, I wonder when the next movie is going to be, or when are they going to contact us about that? So there's this certain rhythm to life that has developed of when we're filming and then when is a premiere happening. But the friends and family thing of the premiere, even though we were quiet around the Freaky Farley Manch Vegas time, those premieres were fantastic. I mean, it's a real day for people who have any connection to either being in it or have a family member in it to make the effort to come to the theater. And we Farley was renting out like a nice real theater, and it's like the little guys taking over for a day. They're showing Hollywood movies on the other side, and then in one of the halls on one day where it's a one screening of River Beast, and those were definitely cool moments. So even though it wasn't a lot of success, those like financial or anything, those premieres were really fun. And we started with very low expectations too, so it wasn't like we were let down. I think we're both very rational and know that this a weird little druid movie or a homemade like slasher movie isn't going to make a lot of money. You're not doing it for the money, so that hasn't changed. It's just for if you got the drive to do it, just try to keep feeding that drive and staying productive.
I like, and I just want to say, I find y'all so inspiring, and I know a lot of people do as well. Like, it is really like just seeing your keep making movies and just the movies you make and how you put them together. I know it, for people working, the little guys around everywhere trying to make art really like hits home, and I do think of y'all like kind of as a North Star sometimes when I'm struggling on working on a project, and I'm like, just think about Charlie and Matt making their movies. They keep going and they keep being good, So it is the work is not just for yourselves. It also is, I think, really affecting people around the world. And I hope it keeps doing that. Do you have any questions that you've wanted to be asked but haven't by me or otherwise?
Ask me
How'd I get so
about
handsome?
no, ask me about the nitty-gritty aspects of any given day of shooting.
Can you tell me about the nitty-gritty aspects of any given day of shooting?
Yes, the thing
Good
is
question.
nobody like there's the glamour of filmmaking, okay? And then there's the nitty-gritty, and it's the nitty-gritty is we figure out which scenes are we filming on Saturday and what do we need. And we probably should have looked into this 2 weeks ago because we need a bunch of props and now we're scrambling for it. And then it's like we need like this week in particular, I needed to get bubble bath foam, and it's just like to be seeking out bubble bath juice or whatever it is on a random Tuesday for your mood, like and that's just one part of the process, like one of so many other parts of the process is in where and it's like Tom Cruise does not have to go get the bubble bath syrup, six days before filming. Like he's just, he's getting like a mud treatment like on his face or whatever. And it's just so but it's awesome. It's like, oh, I have a mission today. Like I gotta find the bubble bath stuff. And or then it was like, oh, we had a scene that involved a small TV for this movie. Like a character's in the bathtub watching a TV on a small TV, and then we're like, oh, we don't have a small TV. So I'm quickly on Amazon, and it's like I don't want to spend too much money on a small TV, but we gotta do it. Like it's like we have to do it. Why? Because we said we would, and like what he sees on the TV is key to the plot. So I'm ordering it, and it's like, oh, gotta do it, overnight delivery and whatnot. And basically, it just adds like side quests. Your life is suddenly filled with all these exciting side quests. And knowing that you're doing it for this the for the for a work of art, and there's so many examples of that. Another one I like to bring up is like shooting Heard She Got Murdered. We wanted to film at the top of this like incline, but it had been we had had a snowstorm prior to when we were going to film it. And so, again, on a random Tuesday, I got a few hours before the sun goes down and I have time. I go to this incline and I climb up it and the snow and the ice just to see how easy it is to get up there for me and the equipment and the actors. And I spend 40 minutes up and 40 minutes down and determine we can't film here, you know? And because it's too hard to go up here, we gotta. So then I have to find a new location that kind of matches it. And again, it's like, oh, this is great. What would I have been doing otherwise? Like I would have just been, scrolling TikTok, And so this is so much more exciting.
Yeah, it's like in your blood to keep doing all these tasks. There's so many dang tasks. Like the second I wake up, I'm also thinking like, well, like for Evil Puddle, like what am I gonna do today to help get it more close to being finished, you know? And that's a part of every day. It just, while you have a movie in the works, it is, unless there's a very good reason about like something's going on and you don't have time to even edit like half a scene or something. But there's always some aspect of work, fixing the sound or organizing something, or, you could always be making progress. So there's the fact, I guess, now that we're editing one and right and still filming it a little bit has led production and post-production at the same time. It is generally easier, I think, to let people take part in filming though, because it's a little bit of like a homework vibe if they're doing post-production for you versus it might take longer. Like if you need somebody to do graphics for yourself. But if you just if you say show up and film with us for 2 hours, and you're kind of like there as part of the party. I feel like that's a nice way to get people involved. They get to meet other people. We did that on Evil Puddle with the crowd, Farley, I would say. They weren't there too long and they got to be in a nice chunk of the movie and really probably arguably more, maybe not even arguably more exciting to see the filming than to see the behind the scenes stuff. But
Yeah, no, yeah, no one wants to help with editing. Yeah,
yeah.
editing. That's nitty gritty.
That's it. That's the nitty gritty too. I think that's the part that when you were talking about nitty gritty, there's the thing that people just they show up and film their thing in, a couple months ago, and they're like, I'm done. But I mean, you and
Yeah.
me are still like every day thinking about like the music and the editing and.
Yeah.
Well, it was great. Great question for you all, Matt. Charlie, anything on this? Any questions you want me to ask you while in our final minutes?
You could ask us about how we sold Manch Vegas to Netflix.
How did you sell Manch Vegas? That's a great. Thank you. Wow, you both should have interviewed yourselves. How did you sell Manch Vegas to Netflix?
Short version, we were cold calling like distribution places that we would pick up like a DVD and look at the back and see who represented it or who put it out. And through trying to contact Netflix when they were disc rental only, someone at Netflix actually answered an email and said, "We don't handle, you can't directly contact us, but go through someone else."
And
And
they gave
that
a
someone else,
list. Was it just one?
I think it was mostly one. And that someone else was this other go-between guy, this some conglomerate place. And we were like, okay, that'll help get the movie out a little bit. This is before streaming.
Yeah, we
So.
really have to emphasize here. Some people might not even know Netflix before streaming was a company that would mail DVDs to your house, you know?
Yeah, and they had a lot of weird stuff too, like tons of variety. So we contact this guy, and Farley's doing a lot of the talking, but some fast talking businessman in an office.
Yeah, well, let me add.
Yeah.
I emailed him once, and
Okay.
I get a phone call on my answering machine. Matt, in the future, call me if you have a question. No
Phone
emails.
calls
Call me.
only. I don't like a paper trail. So yeah, we get in contact with this ramshackle company that is apparently knows someone at Netflix, and he's like, Matt, Charlie, here's what you gotta do. I don't want the DVD cases, but we're gonna buy like the minimum amount of your movie. So here's what you do. You open up all the cases, and these were discs we pressed ourselves. put them on a spindle, you ship them to this address.
Yeah.
Then you enter in the ISBN and this artwork at this website. Don't talk to me. You send it to this web, you send it to this email address, and it gets in the system. And for a short time, using that random guy in this tiny office somewhere, we were able to get Manch Vegas and Freaky Farley in the system
30
at net.
copies of each. Yeah.
30 copies of each, just the bare disc. People could log on to their account and get it shipped in a red envelope to their house.
Yeah. And
Eventually,
I mean that was the biggest place you could be in terms of video rental in 2009, 2010, or whatever it was.
So I think they had enough of a open mind and willing to take a flyer on us for 30 discs. Doesn't cost that much and it adds to their selection. I think that all those discs got broken in the mail over time, and then they did
Yeah.
not reorder. And although we asked, like, hey, why don't you? I heard about this movie called Manch Vegas, which is really good. Would you guys maybe stock that again? It did not happen. But it was our brush with the sort of ultra low budget distribution
Distribution, yeah,
and fun.
but they actually paid though too. We
They
did get
actually paid.
paid for both of the titles, and they got us on Netflix. So, and it was cool. And the whole time, Charlie and I are like, this is the kind of distributor businessman that we would hear about in documentaries about 80s VHS movies, you know? And it's like, this is so cool. We're being manipulated by crass businessmen, just like our heroes were.
And like, guys, I cut you a check after expenses. I went out to dinner that night, minus my overhead fee. You each get $14.22,
That's
basically.
not true. We got a legit number for the product. Can I
Three
ask one?
digits, though, three digits.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Yeah, damn. Better than some of these heroes would have gotten, I believe.
Yeah, I think we got about $600
Yes.
for the two spindles of DVDs. And frankly, we would have done it for free just to get onto Netflix. You know, that's the thing.
Wow, that's $600. It still seems so small for all the work.
Divide by two.
Of course, divide by two. Well,
Take out taxes.
Yeah.
The
Yeah.
cost
Well,
of discs that we made.
that, yeah.
I'm
Well, I
just
mean,
kidding. I'm just kidding.
that's why I say, I mean, we need the tens of thousands of regular supporters, frankly, of people either buying the Blu-ray on Gold Ninja or buying the movie on Vimeo. And we're planning on the next movie to start the movie with a card on the screen that says, if you did not personally pay to watch this movie, please dial 603-644-0048 to arrange a way to pay the producers. Because it's just like, like this isn't like, oh, let me just find a way to stream a major motion picture for as cheap as possible. It's like, we're losing so much time and money on these things. People should want to reimburse us.
Yeah, in-person lecturer at each screening. Like a guy in a suit who's like, let me tell you about this,
Feel
these
good.
pretty.
Nothing like making our audience feel guilty before the movie's even started.
They used to do that. They're in the 50s, there was a they used to sell these like movies. They would have little booklets they would sell about the topic. Usually it would be like a they used to call them hygiene pictures. It would be like a But they would make more money off of selling these pamphlets for like a dollar, and the guy, a wheeler dealer guy there, than maybe on
Yeah,
the
that's what we
media
gotta
stuff.
sell plush Pippi pets is what we gotta do, you know? So Boston Johnny's all a ploy to make money off of plush Pippi pets.
Try a plus.
Sorry, Kai. Yeah, we forgot you're even here. How are you doing?
I figure I could. I think I could do this before the screening. I could show up and just kind of harangue everybody and be like, "Listen, afterwards, you're gonna have a good time, all right? You afterwards, you go
Yeah.
home. You go rent some movies, you go buy some movies, you go buy some tank tops from the sites, you know?
Yeah. Local legends tank tops.
I have the Local Legends tank top. I really like,
Do
yeah.
Nice.
I wear it, and it's very comfortable, and it makes me and people in the street don't understand. They're like, I see people, everyone's like, it's,
Yeah.
I hope they take the next step and Google it. All right, to close it out, any final sentiments for the audience? Anything you want to impart?
Okay, my final message to the good people listening to this is life is so boring. It's so boring. Look, let's be honest. You're spending a combined total of 8 to 12 hours a day watching TV, your computer, or your phone. Okay? You do have time to make a movie. And once you start doing it, your juices are going to be flowing, and suddenly life is exciting. You have tons of things you have to do, and you're gonna engage more with your friends. You're gonna get out there into the world. So get started. Just write one scene every week for a scene or two every week for 6 months. Boom, you got a script, and then just start filming it. Okay, and no matter what, you have to finish the movie. And in the end, it's the best of times. It's the worst of times, but you'll have a finished product. And no one can take that away from you. And if no one else loves it, you and everyone else in the movie are gonna get a kick out of it. And you'll come out of it with so much appreciation for any movie that got finished, no matter how bad it is. You're like, oh, those people, they moved mountains just to make this happen, because it's hard for us. But the thing, it's hard for major motion pictures too. Like a $100 million budgeted film, you ask the director and they're just like, oh, it was a nightmare and I loved every second of it. And so you should all do that. Get to work, people.
Yeah, join the tribe of making a low budget movie. Show people what your neighborhood's like, what your friends and family are like, and find people
Yeah.
who are looking for a creative outlet. And I would be very happy to watch something like that as opposed to something bland and boring,
Yeah.
that a whole committee has like forced the story a certain direction, or it's gotten
Yeah.
so like homogenized
Watered
that.
down,
Yeah,
yeah.
watered down. I mean, it's cool to see something where you don't know exactly what's going to happen next, and it's got this freedom to just like go where it's going to go.
Great point.
Well,
Thank you.
that's a great way to end it. I'm going to stop recording a second. Thank you all so much for chatting to me. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, but you and thank you, Buff, and everyone who's going to watch our movies.
I'm sure they would. I'm sure they've enjoyed themselves.
Thank you. Thank you.